Good morning. Homeland Security says the man suspected of shooting two National Guard members in Washington, D.C. came from Afghanistan. President Trump wants to review the cases of all Afghans who fled after the fall of the Taliban. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Jaime Martinez, Trump is also freezing all immigration applications from Afghan nationals and calling for 500 more National Guard troops to D.C. How will the shooting change how the Guard prepares for deployments? It's Thursday, November 27th. If you're looking to start some new Thanksgiving traditions this year, we've got some non-traditional suggestions. So it's probably too late to defrost that turkey in your freezer if you haven't already. Why not just lob it as far as you can? We'll hear from some turkey toss champions. News is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump calls the shooting of two National Guard members blocks from the White House yesterday an act of terror. Both are in critical condition. The Department of Homeland Security says the suspect is a 29-year-old immigrant from Afghanistan who entered the U.S. after the Taliban took control of the country and that he's in custody. Trump addressed the nation last night.
We must now re-examine every single alien who has entered our country from Afghanistan under Biden, and we must take all necessary measures to ensure the removal of any alien from any country who does not belong here or add benefit to our country.
Trump says he's mobilizing an additional 500 troops to the nation's capital. So far, there's no word on a motive. More than 50 people are dead, hundreds remain missing after a fire broke out at a housing complex in Hong Kong yesterday. Cherise Pham has more.
This is one of the deadliest fires in Hong Kong's history. It broke out at a public housing complex that's home to about 4,600 people. More than 24 hours later, the fire was under control, but firefighters were still battling fires in several buildings, and residents are still trapped. The Hong Kong Fire Services said an elderly man had been rescued from the 31st floor of one of the buildings. The high-rise apartment towers had been under renovation and covered in bamboo scaffolding. Three people who work for the construction company responsible for the renovations have been arrested on suspicion of manslaughter. Hong Kong police said that construction material found around the buildings did not meet safety standards, were highly flammable, and may have been the reason the fire spread so quickly. For NPR News, I'm Cherise Pham in Hong Kong.
A panel of three federal judges is allowing North Carolina to use a newly drawn congressional map in the 2026 elections. Adam Wagner of member station WUNC has more.
Republican legislators in North Carolina drew the new map to give their party a clear advantage in 11 of the state's 14 congressional races. The North Carolina NAACP and voting rights group Common Cause are among those challenging the new map. They asked the court to prevent it from being used next year because, they say, it dilutes the power of black voters in the region. Legislators have said repeatedly their focus was gaining the maximum possible advantage for Republicans amid a national race to secure safe seats. In Wednesday's ruling, the three-judge panel said plaintiffs failed to prove that the maps intentionally discriminate against black voters by diluting their power. Candidate filing starts Monday. For NPR News, I'm Adam Wagner in Raleigh.
World financial markets, Asian markets were higher by the close. The Nikkei, the main market in Japan, up 1.2%. The Hang Seng up a fraction. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Pope Leo is in Ankara, Turkey, on his first foreign trip. He's fulfilling Pope Francis's plans to mark an important Orthodox anniversary and to bring a message of peace to the region at a crucial time for efforts to end Russia's war in Ukraine and ease Mideast tensions. His visit comes as Turkey has cast itself as a key intermediary in peace negotiations for the conflicts between Ukraine and Gaza. Leo will meet with President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and then move into Istanbul for 3 days of interfaith meetings before he heads to Lebanon. The giant balloon and marching bands of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade will be stepping off in New York City in just a matter of hours. NPR's Netta Ulubi reports this year's broadcast follows record ratings last year.
The parade is being broadcast on NBC stations and streamed online on Peacock, once in the morning and again in the afternoon, if you cannot be there to record it for social media. Last year's telecast brought in more than 31 million viewers. Thanksgiving, it seems, is for television as well as for turkey. It's one of the biggest TV viewing days of the year. The Macy's Thanksgiving Parade for 2025 will feature 34 giant balloons and more than two dozen floats, many of which serve as enormous mobile advertisements for various things. Celebrities set to perform and promote their projects include stars from the films Wicked for Good and K-pop Demon Hunters. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
And I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
He's a bird. I think he's rather plain. He's a super mayor.
St. Paul, Minnesota has had lots of mayors, but only a handful has been as colorful as Charlie McCarty, and none of them have had two songs written about him.
Here and there and everywhere when trouble just begins.
In 1970, Charlie McCarty became St. Paul's first and only super mayor. He slicked his hair, wore a flower in his buttonhole, and in the wee hours, rode around in his Lincoln Continental supercar, following the police scanner to crimes in progress. Bad guys better get off his streets.
Psychedelic lights are flashing. See that supercar go dashing. Someone's called for help. Super Mayor's on.
Every superhero needs a theme song. Two St. Paul groups, the Hillbillies and the Gallivanters, produced them. Unfortunately, Charlie McCarty lost his battle for re-election. But on late nights with the sirens ringing in the air, the legend of Super Mayor lives on.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California. Two West Virginia National Guard members are in critical condition after they were shot near the White House in Washington, D.C. Wednesday afternoon. The city's mayor described the attack as targeted. The suspected gunman, who was also shot, is in custody. And the attack comes as President Trump has deployed the National Guard to several cities around the country, a pattern that has been controversial and challenged in the courts. For more, we're joined by NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Kat, tell us about what happened with the shooting.
Yeah, the shooting occurred about 2:15 p.m. yesterday. At a press conference, the D.C. Metropolitan Police said that the gunman came around a corner and opened fire at the guard members while they were on patrol. Nearby guard members quickly intervened and subdued the shooter. Police say it's unclear at this time who shot the shooter. The two injured guard members, who, like you said, were from West Virginia, were both rushed to hospitals. Earlier yesterday, West Virginia Governor Patrick Morrisey had said the guard members were killed, but walked that back less than an hour later. Authorities have since said that the two are in critical condition.
And it sounds like the president is talking about the suspected shooter.
Yeah, in a video statement yesterday, President Trump said the shooter was someone who came to the U.S. from Afghanistan. The Department of Homeland Security later identified the shooter as Rahmanullah Lakhanwal and said he came to the U.S. as part of a Biden administration program called Operation Allies Welcome that allowed thousands of Afghans to enter the country after the Taliban retook power of Afghanistan back in 2021. Those people came in on two-year grants of parole, then later had to apply for other ways to stay in the country permanently, like asylum, and go through rigorous screening. NPR has not yet independently verified when or why Lakhanwal entered the country, and a motive for the shooting is not yet known. In that video last night, Trump called the attack an act of terror.
We must now re-examine every single alien who has entered our country from Afghanistan under Biden.
He also repeated anti-immigrant rhetoric. The Trump administration then announced that it had stopped processing immigration applications for Afghan nationals. And A, this will likely affect a number of Afghans who worked with the U.S. government or NATO forces during the 20-year war in Afghanistan and have largely been left in limbo after the Trump administration curbed immigration.
Yeah. Now, the National Guard, back to them for a second, because they've been in D.C. for a few months now. Why were they sent here in the first place?
Yeah, there have been more than 2,000 National Guard troops in D.C. from several states, including West Virginia, since August, when Trump ordered the deployment over concerns about the city's crime rate. This has been part of a pattern of Trump deploying the National Guard to Democratic-led cities around the country, often against the wishes of local governors and authorities. And D.C. is unique. Unlike the 50 states, the president has the authority to deploy the National Guard to D.C. Now, I live in D.C., and in the past few months, I see members of the National Guard pretty much every day. They're out patrolling the streets in groups, and they've been helping with beautification efforts. But these deployments have been very controversial. In places like Portland, Oregon, or Chicago, federal judges almost immediately intervened and blocked them. Those are still tied up in legal battles. And in D.C., a federal judge just last week ruled that the use of troops in the city was unlawful and ordered an end to the deployment. That has yet to take effect to give the administration time to appeal. Meanwhile, after yesterday's attack, Trump doubled down, saying he was ordering an additional 500 troops to the city.
That's NPR's Kat Lonsdorf. Kat, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more about this shooting and the investigation, we've called Juliet Kayyem. She served as Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Department of Homeland Security during the Obama administration. As the Homeland Security Advisor in Massachusetts, she oversaw the state's National Guard. Today, she serves as Faculty Chair of the Homeland Security Project at Harvard University. So, Juliet, this shooting, is it possible to change maybe the way in which Guard members are preparing for missions on the streets of major American cities now?
It would be possible, but it has to begin with understanding what the mission is. And I think that's one of the challenges right now. The National Guard in D.C., like all the other National Guards deployed by President Trump, were sent to essentially blue cities to do what's called high visibility patrols. These are, you know, these are literally what, as advertised. These are the Trump administration wanted a lot of members of the National Guard in uniform to essentially just sort of roam the street. Some of them do beautification campaigns. So it's difficult to know how you would better protect, for example, the troops, the National Guard troops deployed in cities under the mission that they are in right now.
Yeah. Now, President Trump has called for the deployment of 500 more National Guard troops in Washington, considering everything that's happened, not only just recently, but in the last few months. What do you think that might do to the safety of members of the Guard and for the people of D.C.?
So 500 is not a lot sort of overall, but it's a lot for D.C., considering the deployment has just been a couple thousand. I think we err in believing that quantity is the problem, right? That if only we did more troops, then they would be safer. That's just not a sophisticated way of looking at it. The problem is the mission. We have deployed National Guard members who join the National Guard not for these purposes. They join the National Guard to support and their neighbors in their states. They've been deployed to D.C. under a very nebulous mission, and it's the mission that is the challenge, right? It's what are they there for? What are the rules of engagement? What are the metrics for success? What's our standard operating procedures? All the questions that you would ask in any normal situation have not been asked or defined by the Pentagon. So its response yesterday was, okay, well, we'll just add more, as if that is the problem. It is not. The challenge is, of course, protecting the National Guard when they're deployed, and that begins with understanding and defining for them what the mission is.
Considering, Juliet, how closely you've worked with the National Guard over the years, I'm wondering if you've heard from people who have chosen to enlist in this part-time military service. What have they been saying?
So most have not chosen it, and most are confused by it. I have strong ties with National Guard members in my state of Massachusetts, but elsewhere, and have spoken to many of them that have been deployed in other cities. And And I mean, the data is pretty clear. There's been some polling that this is a deployment that they don't understand and don't particularly like. It is a deployment that their leadership doesn't know how to explain. I mean, for someone who, you know, these victims from West Virginia, you know, they're taken from their homes, from their home state. They are sent to a city where they know no one. They are taken away from their jobs because most National Guard members are not full-time, and they are deployed in conflict with a city that they don't know, but it's an American city. It's been confusing for everyone all around, and that's why in the past, regardless of what the legal standards are, this has never been done in the past, to deploy a military asset for traditional law enforcement purposes or beautification purposes, which serve no public safety aim.
President Trump also said the U.S. must, quote, re-examine every Afghan who came here since the Taliban fell. Juliet, how would that logistically work?
The Trump administration will essentially, I think there's no question about it, close all processes for Afghans right now that have been trying to make permanent their immigration status. What that looks like a few weeks or months from now, we don't know. But there are a lot of Afghans who supported us, the United States, during the Afghan war, who have been brought to the United States or are pending permanent status in the United States for their support of us in the Afghan war, who are now going to be impacted quite negatively by the actions of one individual from Afghanistan.
That's former Homeland Security official Juliet Kayyem, who chairs the Homeland Security Project at Harvard's Kennedy School. Juliet, thanks for sharing some of your Thanksgiving with us.
Thank you.
The government shutdown affected federal assistance programs such as SNAP and Head Start. WPLN's Cynthia Abrams reports on the impact to a lesser-known lifeline.
The shutdown ended on November 12th, but back when the government was still closed, mother of two, Denise Simpson, visited Nashville's Metro Action Commission, a local agency that helps people in poverty. Simpson is a SNAP recipient, and without that federal food aid, costs were mounting. Those benefits have since resumed.
It's been tough, especially being a mother of two boys and one of them being special needs. And he requires so much. It's hard to be able to take care of your family that's needed.
Simpson is applying for the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, otherwise known as LIHEAP. The federal program that's administered through states provides one-time payments to people who need help with their gas or electric bills. Simpson says she needs that help, especially as temperatures drop, to keep her family secure.
I don't care what nobody says, you have to be super mom with assistance. It takes a village.
But weeks after applying, Simpson hasn't heard back. That's because during the shutdown, none of the funds from LIHEAP were dispersed. In Tennessee, that's roughly $72 million.
As the program was delayed, the more families found themselves in crisis.
That's Lisa McCrady-Beverly, who works for Metro Action.
And then during all of this, we had the disruption as it relates to SNAP. And so when you have all of those different scenarios with families or individuals whose incomes are already very, very limited, it exacerbates the situations that they're already having to deal with.
As families face a delay, a spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services, which releases the funds to states, tells NPR News that it is, quote, moving swiftly to distribute annual awards. An HHS official not authorized to speak publicly said the funds should be released by the end of the month. But Tennessee still hasn't received them. Meanwhile, residents are in need. So far in November, the state has received close to 13,000 applications for utility assistance. For NPR News in Nashville, I'm Cynthia Abrams.
This is NPR News. Thank you.
KPXC brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals whose ideas, solutions, and discoveries expand people's expectations of what's possible. MacFound.org. And from the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at CySimsFoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez. Forget about the turkey, the cranberry sauce, the wiggly, jiggly jello salad. Have we got some Thanksgiving traditions for you? Our crack team of researchers have scoured the country in search of atraditional traditions that'll make you rethink your Thanksgiving. We start in Boston, where turkey isn't just a meal, it is a projectile. Radio station KISS 108 has been holding a turkey-tossing contest for as long as anyone can remember. Local high schools compete to see who can hurl and catch a frozen bird. And before you cry foul, KISS 108's Billy Costa says turkey-tossing is a whole lot harder than it looks.
It's kind of heavy to just pick it up and throw it like a football. So the motion is that they have their back to the receiver and they bend their knees. And they go into usually a 2 or 3 step pump, you know, pump one, pump two, yeah. Pump three. And then in the air goes the bird. It's frozen solid, by the way. So the impact of the toss usually will knock them down onto their backs.
So if someone establishes a successful catch and another team beats them, will the original team be allowed to try and best the other team's length?
No, there are no redos. You get one shot, and the school that throws and catches it the furthest wins. And I got to tell you, immediately, pandemonium on the field.
Everett High School has won the turkey toss 5 years in a row. Football players Shane McKenzie and Dominic Papa were the 2023 champions. So, Dominic, I know that in football, you're taught to catch the ball out in front and then bring it into your body. Because if you catch it with your chest, I mean, that means the ball typically, or the bird in this case, will kind of bounce off your chest and you lose. So how much of the way football is played is applicable here?
Nowhere near what catching a turkey is. I kind of make like a basket and like while like it's falling down on me, I kind of like fall down with the turkey. So like the momentum of the turkey, it's just coming down with me.
What would you say, Dominic, are some of the top mistakes that catchers make in the turkey toss?
Maybe being too scared of how heavy it is and how like it's like a brick.
Yeah.
It can't just be, you can't be scared of the bird.
Can't be scared of the bird. No, I know. You can't be scared of the bird. Shane, and championships to uphold. I mean, that's some pressure. I mean, for the people that follow you.
Oh. I've played in multiple playoff overtime games, you know, in football in my career. As crazy as it sounds, you have the entire city tuning in to watch this thing. It was the most pressure I've ever felt in my entire life. Ever.
Would it be fair, Shane, to say that this is, at the moment, your biggest accomplishment in life?
I wouldn't go as far as saying that, but it's probably number two.
All right, blunt force trauma to the chest is not your idea of a good Thanksgiving. No problem. I understand. Why don't you head out then to the Santa Barbara Zoo in California? Every Thanksgiving, it gives leftover Halloween pumpkins to the animals. Ellie Cullip is a senior keeper there.
We truly only give them pumpkins this one time a year. We love stimulating our animals and enriching them and getting them to engage in things. And the animals at the zoo are intelligent enough to understand when the keepers are giving them something new and different.
Some animals like to eat the pumpkin.
Our capybaras will eat them entirely. They'll eat every last little morsel of it. We have macaws and cockatoos. And there's one cockatoo in particular. His name is Reggie. He's a sulfur-crested cockatoo, and he loves to destroy the pumpkin.
Turns out Reggie is a bit of a show-off.
He feeds off of people's reactions to him, so I think he has such a blast not only destroying the pumpkin, but having people watch him destroy the pumpkin.
Other animals enjoy a more subtle pumpkin experience.
We'll give them to our big cats as like a different scent that they love to just like smell and rub on.
The Pumpkin Love Fest draws thousands of visitors to the zoo.
It's almost as popular as a busy 4th of July weekend.
In other words, it's a gorgeous day for all. Now on to southern Iowa, where Danish immigrants settled in the 1800s. Two towns, Elkridge and Kimbleton, have celebrated Yule Fest the Friday and Saturday after Thanksgiving for 47 years. It's a festival to kick off the Christmas season. Organizer Sean Sayers said Yule Fest wouldn't be Yule Fest without a specific Danish-American food, and I'm going to let him pronounce it.
Ebelskiva medistapulse, which is essentially for the non-Danish pancakes and sausage. The Ebelskiva is a special round pancake, so it's a sphere rather than flat. And then medistapulse is a special kind of sausage that in Denmark is not eaten with Ebelskiva whatsoever. And Danes actually think this tradition is very odd, but to Americans it seems more stereotypical or normal.
He had me at pancakes and sausage, but nothing puts the medistapulse in the Ebelskiva quite like the traditional Danish Christmas drink known as glug.
I call it drinking a Christmas candle, except without all the carcinogens.
Glug is made from a mix of cinnamon, cloves, and cardamom combined with a sweet red table wine.
So if you want to have a child-friendly get-together or no alcohol involved, you can easily cut it with apple cider. That works really well.
Then you heat it up.
Either on the stove or a crock pot, or you can do kind of one of those party coffee canisters. And you take the lid off and just let the steam out, and it fills your whole house with this just wonderful aroma. It's important to us to remind ourselves that we are a community, and this is what we were founded with, and this is how we link together, and showing future generations that this is what being a community means. It's to have traditions, it's to have focal points as a means of coming together.
Whether you find that community by flinging frozen turkeys, watching animals annihilate pumpkins, or drinking too much glug at Yule Fest, it's okay to be different at Thanksgiving. As Winnie the Pooh's friend Piglet said, the things that make me different are the things that make me me. Happy Thanksgiving. This is NPR News.
D.C. area consultant Ransom Miller has organized a food distribution project every Thanksgiving for the last 30 years. He says the need from families this holiday season has grown.
We have never gotten the amount of calls that we got this year.
Why he and countless other volunteers are thankful to give back on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXC. It's 5:29 on this Thanksgiving morning. We've got some special things going on this Thanksgiving morning. Staff librarian Tammy Bobrowski, who is talking with Mike Herbert. He is a professor emeritus from Bemidji State University who has a new book. He has collected stories of women in Beltrami County who served in World War II. That's coming up at 7:45. 5. Also from our friends at Interlock and Public Radio in Michigan, it's the Points North podcast. We meet a man who has been watching the sunrise every morning on Lake Superior since 2019. And then before 9 o'clock, my conversation with Aaron Brown. We're talking about being grateful for grandpas. We are grateful for you as you helped us in the last 6 months or so make it through the crisis of losing federal funding. Help us look to the future to find new funding sources. People have continued to donate and help us out. You can do so now by texting the word donate to 218-326-1234. We keep you connected to where you live. That includes telling you about some of the free Thanksgiving meals that are going on today. Volunteers in Brainerd at the American Legion Post have an 11 to 1 p.m. free full Thanksgiving meal. In Pequot Lakes, it's from 11 to 3 o'clock with a free will donation. MJ's Lodge and Resort in Pengilly has a Thanksgiving meal from 1 to 4 o'clock and a free will donation for the Nashwalk Food Shelf. In Bovee, the Triumphant Life Church is hosting their 17th annual free Thanksgiving community meal from 11 to 5. Northwoods Chapel has their 5th annual community Thanksgiving. That's at the Sand Lake Community Center in Spring Lake. The Old Scenic Community Church in Big Fork has their free meal on Thanksgiving from 1 to 4. In Floodwood, the New Life Community Church has a free meal for folks beginning at noon. Grand Rapids Centennial Rotary Club offering a free Thanksgiving meal from 11 to 1 today at St. Joseph Catholic Church. Right now, though, it's time for our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer.
On today's date, November 27th, 1999, a pair of brown creepers visits my feeder area. They don't come to the feeder. They're not seed-eating birds. I've got suet out, and they don't come to the suet. Their intent is to glean any insect that they can find from among the crevices of the bark of the Norway pines in my yard. And they do a fabulous job. As if well designed by nature, they have this long decurved beak which allows them to probe crevices and crannies and find any little morsel that might be edible down in there. And oddly enough, they seem to be in partnership with the nuthatches, because the nuthatches will work the tree from top to bottom, giving them one look at the things that may be hiding in the bark. And the creepers work the tree from bottom to top, so they are looking at the other side of the bark in its crevices and crannies. It's an interesting relationship, but one that must be awfully tough if you're a spider or a small worm trying to hide out the winter in the bark of the Norway pine.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California. The last outstanding criminal case against President Trump is now closed. A judge in Georgia dismissed the historic election interference case in its entirety on Wednesday. That's after a special prosecutor moved to drop charges against Trump and his remaining co-defendants. NPR's Sam Greenglass joins us now. Tell us more about the decision to drop the charges, Sam.
This decision was made by a special prosecutor named Pete Skandalakis. He took over the case after a court removed Fulton County District Attorney Fawnie Willis last year for an alleged conflict of interest stemming from a personal relationship she had with a special prosecutor. It then fell to Skandalakis, head of a state prosecutor's council, to decide what to do with the case. And after reviewing the evidence and the law, he concluded all charges should be dismissed.
Okay, what was his rationale?
Skandalakis questioned the strength of some of the charges, including the racketeering charge at the heart of the indictment. And he concluded that the federal justice system would have been a better place for this prosecution. Federal prosecutors did bring charges against Trump, but that case was dropped as Trump returned to the White House. Skandalakis also noted it would have been illogical and unduly burdensome to sever Trump from the case and continue against the other defendants.
You know, it's kind of hard to forget about the phone call that started it all, Sam, the find 11,780 votes call.
Yeah, this investigation began not long after that call when Trump asked Georgia's Secretary of State to find him the votes he needed to win Georgia. DA Fawnie Willis eventually asked a grand jury for an indictment, which she announced in a dramatic news conference in August 2023.
The defendants engaged in a criminal racketeering enterprise to overturn Georgia's presidential election result.
Trump and his co-defendants pleaded not guilty. His mugshot at the Fulton County Jail is one of the enduring images of this time. Four defendants later accepted plea deals, and those convictions remain.
Now that the case is over, Sam, I gotta imagine the president has said at least a few things about it.
Sure. Trump wrote on social media that law and justice have prevailed in Georgia. We have not heard from the Fulton District Attorney's Office, but I did call up Georgia State University law professor Anthony Michael Kreiss, and he told me it would have been important for the public even just to hear the evidence at trial.
This was really an opportunity for justice and reconciliation and for a kind of truth telling. And that has been squandered.
Has been squandered, he says. So then what's the legacy then of this this years long effort then?
Trump recently pardoned allies allegedly involved in the effort to overturn the 2020 result. The ones named were never charged in a federal case, but they were charged in Georgia, where any convictions would have been immune from the pardon. Now those charges have been dropped. With the end of this case, it's extremely likely Trump will never face trial over his activities after the 2020 election. You know, as Kreiss pointed out to me, the fact that this case fizzled could embolden future candidates to try to overturn an election, and that the criminal justice system has shown it may not be equipped to respond.
That's NPR's Sam Greenglass. Sam, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
The holidays will be more stressful than usual for some this year, with rising prices still a concern. NPR's Tovia Smith reports on people who are making painful cuts to their usual traditions.
Many families say they worry this season that there'll be less of what the holidays are all about. Family and food.
My God, is it different this year? I mean, with inflation and then the cost of eggs and cheese and all that stuff, it's ridiculous.
Steve Posey and his wife, India, were grocery shopping in Medford, Massachusetts this week. Not for themselves. They've picked up a second job with Instacart to help cover rising costs. Posey works as a case manager at a veterans organization, and India works in childcare, but they still can't make ends meet. They got their turkey and some canned food from a pantry, and they're scraping together the rest. Posey says it does put a damper on their holiday spirit.
It kind of takes away from the joy. Like, I mean, I don't feel it this year. To be honest, I'm just trying to stay above water.
Still, Posey says his perspective changes when he sees how much the veterans he works with are struggling. Many saw their SNAP food assistance disrupted this month during the government shutdown, and they haven't caught up. Posey says he's seeing the fallout.
We're starting to see a lot more people frustrated, a lot more people angry, a lot more people thieving and stealing. You're starting to see an uptick in violence, especially domestic violence, a lot of substance use, because they're just overwhelmed.
Meantime, a few hundred miles away at a grocery store in Queens in New York City, Rosetta Savannah was doing her holiday shopping. She's among the SNAP recipients still waiting for this month's benefits. So far, she's got half, so her family's Thanksgiving dinner will also be lighter than usual.
We're doing mostly like chicken because chicken is cheaper. I usually bake cakes
and pies. I'm not doing that this year.
She'll also go to the food pantry, she says, hoping to find a small ham.
You just got to get up super early to at least be maybe the 30th person online. And then just wait and see.
Savannah is also one of many who will have less under their Christmas trees this year.
I'm significantly cutting out gifts. There's just no way I can't afford it.
60-year-old Bonnie Green has always considered herself upper middle class. For the holidays, she goes big, as she put it, and she had planned on gifts for her kids and for her first granddaughter's first Christmas. But earlier this year, her job with the National Science Foundation was one of the many eliminated by DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. Now, as a professor at a state college in Pennsylvania, she's making half of what she was.
That's a lot of money that is no longer there. And it's really tough.
For the holidays, it means chicken soup instead of her usual seafood chowder. And forget the beef Wellington and pecan pie. Also, her sister isn't coming for Christmas because of the higher airfare and because she needs to work an extra shift.
I have friends who are like, the economy's never been better. And I don't know what economy they're living in, but it's not mine.
Still, Green says she's lucky compared to the many low-income students at her school. She says campus food pantries are doing nearly double their usual volume, and many students say they may have to drop out one semester short of getting their diploma.
It would be a tragedy beyond words. They will never be able to be at the table without a bachelor's degree. They won't even be invited to the table, and they deserve to be there.
Green, who studies educational outcomes for low-income students, recently set up a scholarship fund to help out. So far, she's raised enough for one of the dozens in need, with help from friends, colleagues, and a donation she managed to scrape together herself. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Tomorrow on Morning Edition, how are the governors of the Federal Reserve thinking about the economy as they get ready to meet next month to decide on interest rates? We're going to hear from Austin Goolsbee, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. You can listen in the NPR app, on a smart speaker, or on this reliable public radio station. This is NPR News.
Sometimes we need a bright spot in our day. That's what you get when you tune in to KAXE.
And our ancestors show us, in the face of incredible adversity, what it looks like to persevere, what it looks like to keep moving your feet forward. You know, Martin Luther King talked about, if you can't walk, then you should crawl, right? But you must keep going. So my encouragement is, you do have an important role to play, and you must not grow weary in doing good. Rest if you must, but do not quit.
It's Minnesota author Sharon McMahon from a KAXE Conversation. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the bright spots that you hear. You can text the word donate right now to 218-326-1234. It's 5:43. Thanks for tuning in. This is the Thursday morning show on this Thanksgiving. Starting in 2026, tax rules related to charitable giving are shifting. This means right now might be the exact right time for you to give to KEXE and other nonprofits. Check with a financial advisor to see if it is a good time for you to make a gift. Your support keeps People Powered Radio strong and ensures a bright future for KEXE. We'd like to thank our business supporters like Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. They help guide your real estate journey in northern Minnesota since 1947. From buying or selling to land or lakeshore, Coldwell Banker Northwoods Realty. You can find them at coldwellbankernorthwoods.com. Weather around our region on this Thanksgiving, it's looking like partly sunny skies to mostly cloudy. Highs in the mid-20s, northwest winds 10 to 20. Evening temperatures tonight in the low teens. Tomorrow, Friday, looks mostly cloudy to partly sunny with highs near 23 and calm winds. We wish you all a very happy Thanksgiving, and we want to hear from you. We are grateful for you, and what are you grateful for in this year? You can text us at 218-326-1234. We've got more news coming up next from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today is our first Thanksgiving without Susan Stamberg, the longtime host of NPR's All Things Considered. She died in October after more than half a century on the air, known as the first woman to host a national news program, and also known as the annual presenter on the air of a cranberry relish that people loved or hated and talked about for decades. Let's listen.
Are you familiar with this recipe?
I am not, but I know it from having you tell me about it.
I'm kind of scared to taste it.
Okay, Pepto-Bismol.
Pepto-Bismol pink.
The color is a little weird.
That's tasty.
You like it?
I do like it.
I'm Coolio with the flow, the ghetto gourmet.
My first rapper.
And I got a fetish for that cranberry relish.
It's delicious.
Okay, the relish is still with us, and so are Susan's granddaughters, Vivian and Lena Stamberg, age 12 and 17, and you're in the studios. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
I saw you sharing looks as we listened to your grandma. What was going through your mind?
Just, like, a lot of memories, I think, and a lot of happy times. I feel like the cranberry relish is just, like, a tradition that is just so fun.
Yeah, I love hearing how, like, everybody gets to kind of partake in our tradition. It's really beautiful.
And it was literally part of your family Thanksgiving, not
yes.
just a thing on the radio.
No,
every year.
Well, I would like you to know that at the NPR Cafe here in our headquarters, they made cranberry relish this week.
Oh,
and
amazing.
I have here some cranberry relish on pretzel rolls. Can I share it with you?
Yes, please.
They wrap them up nicely. Here's one for you.
Thank
oh
you.
Oh, my gosh.
One for you.
Thank you.
And one for me. And
is this our recipe or is this just...
This is Susan Stamberg's cranberry relish.
Okay.
Oh, man. Wow.
Mm-hmm. I think the pretzel and the sausage make it taste better than it usually tastes.
I was thinking exactly the same thing. Go on.
Yeah, I wasn't the biggest fan of the cranberry relish growing up. I mean, it was always kind of be like something that my grandma and my dad ate because my dad was brainwashed. And so...
Excuse me, choked on some relish there. Go on.
It was like they would eat it and then Lena and I would kind of look at each other and like just leave it on our plates.
Do you remember when you became conscious that some large slice of America was aware of this thing that you did?
Definitely. I feel like when I found out and when I saw an article about it first, mm-hmm. it was definitely a surprise because I definitely didn't like it as much when I was younger. So I thought, like, why are these people eating this?
Yeah.
Like, I have to. Because I didn't really know that my grandmother was, like, known on NPR.
Uh-huh.
I was very excited and I was very confused.
Tell me what you generally do for Thanksgiving. What is the family Thanksgiving like for you guys?
Okay. My, like, memory of Thanksgiving is always in D.C. And there would always be, between Thanksgiving dinner and dessert, there'd be a walk, and we'd walk all around the neighborhood, and there'd be this family who would always be doing a scavenger hunt, and one of the things that they had to find was Susan Stamberg, because she'd always take this walk.
Yeah.
On Thanksgiving. Yeah.
That's so great.
I know. It's amazing.
One more question, and this may be difficult to think about, but this is the first Thanksgiving without your grandma. What are your plans?
I'm really happy to be in D.C. I feel like we were deciding if we should come back this year, and I think it's good that we decided to come, just kind of like wrap it all up.
It wouldn't be Thanksgiving if it wasn't here. I feel like it would feel totally different. And
we will be making cranberry relish,
yes.
for sure.
I was wondering, but okay,
yep.
Great.
Gotta keep the tradition alive.
Vivian and Lena Stamberg on this Thanksgiving. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm E. Martinez.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things: a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KAXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KAXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
Many who give thanks today to Social Security.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Trevi Pay, a managed B2B payments platform for global brands, offering zero-touch AR plus tools to help reduce DSO at TreviPay.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. Happy Thanksgiving. First, the deal to reopen the federal government earlier this month reversed mass firings of thousands of federal workers. That included staff at the Community Development Financial Institutions Fund, CDFI. Marketplace's Savannah Peters has that.
The CDFI Fund awards grants to banks, credit unions, and loan funds that work in underserved parts of the country. And the CDFI brand helps those lenders raise private capital.
A relatively small investment of the public sector leverages significant funds from the private sector.
Michael Swack directs the University of New Hampshire's Center for Impact Finance. He says the Trump administration's move to effectively eliminate the CDFI fund was met with rare bipartisan pushback in Congress.
CDFI fund has supported small business and affordable housing lending in districts blue and red, and a number of red states have benefited.
The CDFI fund staff has been reinstated, at least through Congress's January 30th deadline to pass a budget. But lenders fear the fund may be on shaky ground. Some are strategizing to lean less on federal support.
This was a great wake-up call that we're going to have to diversify.
Pete Upton, CEO of the Native CDFI Network, says some of the institutions he works with are lending more conservatively as they wait for grant funding held up by the shutdown or anticipate more cuts to CDFI funding and services. I'm Savannah Peters for Marketplace.
Six Flags is getting a new CEO next month. The theme park chain is struggling for visitors and dollars. Reporter Daniel Ackerman has that.
Dennis Spiegel loves theme parks. As a kid?
I was a ticket taker at Coney Island in Cincinnati, Ohio, not to be confused with New York.
That was 50 years ago, and he still hasn't left the industry.
When was the last time you have been upside down on a theme park ride?
Oh, probably about a week ago.
Just doing some high adrenaline research for his current job as a consultant with International Theme Park Services. And Spiegel says this year was tough for parks. Some reasons were out of their control.
We had extreme heat in the southwest. We had wetness up in the northeast. We had hurricanes on the east coast.
But Spiegel says Six Flags has also faced problems of its own making.
It's really been a ship at sea without a captain for over 10 years. They've moved through quite a few CEOs.
Which he says has led to a lack of continuity in pricing and marketing. Six Flags' stock price responded well to the new CEO announcement. John Riley is a veteran park operator. But the company could get a boost from another name. Football star and Taylor Swift fiancé Travis Kelce recently announced he's investing in the company.
I don't know if he can save Six Flags, but he certainly created a lot of buzz and good press.
Martin Lewison is a professor of business management at Farmingdale State College and a Six Flags investor. And he says in an era when so many kids are glued to their phones, theme parks offer a decent value proposition.
People like to be outdoors. People like to get thrown around on rides.
And for those who don't, some theme parks have had success leaning into live events, says Chris Waronka, an analyst at Deutsche Bank.
Things like pop-up concerts. These aren't going to become concert venues per se, but if you bring in different performers, that makes the parks different every week.
Which could draw repeat customers. And as consumers feel the squeeze of higher prices everywhere they look, a local theme park might become preferable to a splurgy weekend trip, says Arpine Kocharyan, an analyst with UBS.
They're less expensive. They're closer to home.
Plus, what could possibly beat a plate of cheese fries followed by a series of violent loop-de-loops? I'm Daniel Ackerman for Marketplace.
U.S. markets are closed for the holiday here because capital markets never really sleep. They will reopen tomorrow for a shortened trading day.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Revenued, providing working capital for businesses' cash flow needs. Approvals based on revenue, not credit, and funds available in a day at GetRevenued.com. And by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at Schwab.com.
This week on the 90th birthday of Social Security, we're meeting people who rely on the monthly payments. Marketplace's senior economics contributor Chris Farrell has our latest installment.
About a decade ago, Gail Engel in Loveland, Colorado, realized her grandson needed some help. Her daughter, who was in her 20s at the time, was overwhelmed by mental illness and couldn't take care of her children.
She was also diagnosed with bipolar disorder at the age of 16, 17 years old. And so she struggled trying to get into her adulthood.
Gail's grandson, Bryson, was having an especially hard time.
Come to find out, he has fetal alcohol spectrum disorder from her drinking during that time she was pregnant.
He was also diagnosed with autism. Back then, Bryson was spending much of his time at his grandmother Gail's home. So in 2014, when Bryson was 9 years old,
we decided the best thing to do was to adopt him. And we did.
Gail was receiving disability benefits at the time, about $940 a month from Social Security. Her health had deteriorated significantly in her late 50s, including chronic back and neck pain and rheumatoid arthritis. So she had to stop working as a bookkeeper.
I knew that I just couldn't function anymore. Along with the stress of raising my grandson, it was necessary.
The good news was that through Social Security, she could also get a monthly check to help care for Bryson, her dependent.
Once I adopted him, because I was disabled, I was able to get a child benefit, which was over $580 a month. So yes, the financial support was very beneficial. And if I had not have adopted him, I would not have had that resource.
Bryson is now grown up. He's 19 and he still lives with them. Gail and her husband, Joe, now have more time to pursue their passion, camping. They own a motorhome.
I love to cook. And so I had to have a big kitchen. So for a camper, it's pretty good size.
Bryson can't always come on their camping adventures, but he's doing well. He recently landed a job at a metal manufacturing company. I'm Chris Farrell for Marketplace.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Coming up, we bring you news headlines from National Public Radio. An hour from now, it is local news from our region, our Up North Report. I'm Heidi Holton. You should make sure you check multiple times a day, if you can, our website, kaxc.org. You're going to find information about where we live, including how the Department of Education hands off key programs without consulting tribes as required. That is a story available right now. And the United Way of Bemidji area launching holiday gifts for kids program. Also, a list of free Thanksgiving meals across the region. Find that at kaxc.org. It also includes great stories about music or conversations. Dave Simonette from Trampled by Turtles will be playing at the Rife Center this Saturday. And he was in conversation this week with Kari Hedlund, talking about family, farm aid, and a creative year.